Hello and welcome to reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald on this Thursday, April 18th. I'm your reader, Wally Helms. On the front page at the very top across the front, we have a headline, City Taking Steps to Combat PFAS in Water. And this is reported by Andy Piper. In addition to being Eastern Iowa cities, there are at least two other things Dubuque has in common with Comanche, Davenport, Buffalo, Burlington, and Muscatine. They are all situated near the Mississippi River, and their drinking water has tested above the federal limit for PFAS chemicals at least once in the past 3 years. PFAS has also been detected in the water supply at a private campground near Bellevue, Iowa. The Environmental Protection Agency recently issued final standards for acceptable PFAS, or perfluoroalkyl and polyfluoroalkyl substances. Its standards set the maximum allowable amount of PFAS in water in a water system at 4 parts per trillion. 12 water systems in Iowa have tested above that level, including Dubuque's. PFAS are nicknamed forever chemicals because they do not degrade in the environment and build up in people's bodies when consumed. The chemicals, which have been used in industry and consumer products for decades, have been linked to several illnesses and cancers. Corey McCoyd, M-C-C-O-I-D, Corey McCoyd, of the Iowa Department of Natural Resources, oversees compliance with drinking water standards. He said the DNR began sampling water supplies in 2021. The study prioritized high-risk areas and came up with 152 to test first. Who is using PFAS? McCoyd asked, or said. We came up with 1,100 industries across Iowa, including manufacturers, to landfills, to airports, to firefighting training, to publicly owned wastewater treatment facilities. The DNR then looked at where the drinking supplies were located. How close were any wells to those types of sources? McCoy said. We looked at those proximities and then at well vulnerabilities, such as what aquifer it was located in. We looked at what we thought were the worst case scenarios. McCoy said, it is not a surprise that communities along the Mississippi River have detectable PFAS levels in their drinking water. PFAS are in thousands of products which end up at our wastewater treatment plants and at our landfills, McCoy said. Discharge from industrial sources and manufacturers end up in our rivers. We have seen that up and down the Mississippi River, especially communities that use the river as a source for its drinking water, and even those that don't, if their wells are near the river, a lot of them are. Dubuque Water Department Director Christopher Lester said the city draws its water from two aquifers located under the Mississippi River. The city's 5 shallow wells range in depth from 127 feet to 200 feet and pull water from the Apple Plum Alluvial Aquifer. The city's 4 deep wells range in depth from 1,540 feet to 1,800 feet and tap into the Jordan Aquifer. Lester said the Mississippi does not flow directly into Dubuque's wells. The city plans to drill a 5th deep well at an estimated $4.6 million cost in the coming years to reduce its reliance on the shallow wells where PFAS detection has occurred. The city's drinking water first was tested for PFAS in 2022. It last tested above the 4 parts per trillion standard in July 2023, when the level was 5.1 parts per trillion. Dubuque has tested its water quarterly since then and has not exceeded the limit. On a hot summer day, especially if it has been a week or two without rain and people are watering their lawns, our deep wells cannot meet demand, Lester said. We utilized our shallow wells on those days, and that is likely why we had an exceedance. It's why we feel like this new well is going to be very advantageous in keeping us below that 4 points per trillion. Lester said that is not the only step Dubuque is taking to ensure compliance with the EPA standards. Strand Associates of Madison, Wisconsin, put together options for PFAS treatment, and Dubuque plans to implement one of those strategies. Lester said in coming years, the city will rehab the water plant's filtration system and replace its filter media with granular activated carbon. Lester said money is being programmed in the 5-year capital improvement plan to fund that initiative. The EPA highlighted the effectiveness of granular activated carbon by referring to the Cape Fear Public Utility Authority of Wilmington, North Carolina, which ranked among the worst water systems in the U.S. for PFAS contamination. They were much more out of compliance than Dubuque, and that filtration system has kept them under the regulatory limit, Lester said. We are taking this very seriously. Iowa Representative Chuck Eisenhardt, Democrat of Dubuque, attempted to attach a PFAS amendment to an agriculture bill last week. His measure called for mandated testing of biosolids and sewage sludge that is spread on farm fields to improve the soil. Eisenhardt cited a study from Maine which linked the spread of soil enhancements on farm fields and high levels of forever chemicals in those farmers' products, fields, and water. Iowa can heed the yellow and red flags waving in other states, Eisenhardt said on the House floor. This is a buyer beware amendment. We can avoid knowingly spreading poison on our land, spoiling our soil, threatening our drinking water, and endangering public health, Eisenhardt's amendment failed 35-62. McCoy said the Iowa DNR has not yet tested biosolids. We track applications across the state, McCoy said. PFAS are coming from wastewater treatment plants, runoff from airports, landfills, and industry. We just haven't dug into specifically where they are coming from. To point a finger at any one source is difficult and requires really expensive testing. The article is accompanied by a couple of photographs of those mentioned, Christopher Lester and Chuck Eisenhardt. And the lower third of the front page has a large picture of a medical associate's front desk, and the headline is Deep-Rooted Commitment. Medical Associates celebrates 100 years of service, and it's reported by Maya Bond, M-A-I-A, Maya Bond, and Maya is a Report for AmeriCorps member. So the article titled Deep-Rooted Commitment. When Chad Nachman, N-A-C-H-T-M-A-N, Chad Nachman was on the hunt for a job as a physician, he struggled to find a right fit. A Dubuque native, Nachman grew up with a mother who worked for Medical Associates, and he received his health care from the organization. It seemed like everywhere I interviewed was not what I wanted because I was comparing everything to how health care was delivered in my hometown at Medical Associates, he said. So Nachman interviewed for a position at the Dubuque-headquartered health care provider. Now Nachman is a physician and president of the Medical Associates Board of Directors and has been with the company for over 20 years. His long tenure at Medical Associates is just a small blip, though, in its now 100-year history in Dubuque. Medical Associates was founded in April 1924 by three doctors who planned to create a group of physicians from different specialties to provide more efficient health care to the tri-state area. 100 years on, the company has vastly expanded its geographic footprint and the services it provides. Zach Keeling, K-E-E-L-I-N-G, CEO of the clinic and its health plans insurance agency, said the three founding physicians understood the importance of collaboration, and that idea has carried through Medical Associates' legacy. He said patients frequently have multiple diagnoses, so the access to a plethora of specialists Medical Associates provides results in better quality of care. He said the company also knows how to adapt to changing economic conditions, technological advancements, and community needs to remain a key provider in the area. Over the years, the healthcare provider has opened several clinic locations, including partnering with Mercy One Dubuque Medical Center to launch Mercy One Dubuque Cancer Center and starting the Aesthetic Center by Medical Associates. It also has added technology to provide a variety of treatments and procedures, including robot-assisted knee surgeries and transcatheter aortic valve replacements. I think our history has been that we can evolve with what the market and the community needs, so we're in a better position than almost anyone despite the challenges, Keeling said. He said Medical Associates considers its patients part of a large family. Our patients are our community, he said. We're taking care of our family and friends and people you're going to run into in the grocery store. That keeps them aligned with our mission of really providing that high-quality patient care. He said most new Medical Associates employees either came to the healthcare provider as a patient or were referred by a family member or friend. Medical Associates employee roster includes multiple generations or members of a single family, Keeling said. Brad McClyman, a physician and vice president of the Medical Associates Board of Directors, said the company also has several employees who have worked there across multiple decades, which he considers a major asset. I think the patients probably notice that, he said. They see familiar faces. They see very competent faces and people that really come to work every day trying to care for the community. Rick Dickinson, president and CEO of Greater Dubuque Development Corporation, said Dubuque's network of health care providers is a major asset to the community's growth and retention of residents. GDDC's Next Generation Survey, which asks questions of residents 40 years old or younger, showed that quality, affordable health care was the top priority for respondents. We probably take for granted the breadth and depth of quality health care we have in the market, and Medical Associates is a huge part of that, Dickinson said. Keith Takes, T-A-K-E-S, president of Mercy One Dubuque Medical Center, said community members often don't realize that Mercy One and Medical Associates are separate organizations because the two work so closely together, but she doesn't mind it. We feel fortunate to be able to work with such a great partner in taking care of Dubuque and the region, she said. The two have partnered for decades, with Medical Associates doctors providing most of the medical care for the hospitalized patients. The two also are partners in joint ventures such as Tri-State Surgery Center, Tri-State Occupational Health, Family Care Network, and Preferred Health Choices. Takas said, operating for 100 years is no accident and is the result of Medical Associates having solid leadership, being excellent stewards of care, and possessing a strong understanding of community needs. I'm most impressed by the integrity and the deep-rooted commitment that Medical Associates physicians, providers, and team have to their patients and the community, she said. They put the patient first, which is the reason we value the relationship so much. The article is accompanied by a picture, an exterior picture of the Medical Associates West Campus in Dubuque, and there is a large color photo on the front of the reception desk in the oncology department at Medical Associates in Dubuque. Those pictures were taken by Telegraph Herald photographer Steve Gassman. On page 2, the Dubuque and Tri-State page, we have a story by Jake Bourgeois, B-O-U-R-G-E-O-I-S, Bourgeois. Jake Bourgeois, who is writing for the Dyersville Commercial. This is from Farley, Iowa, and the headline, Greenwood's Grocery reopens nearly 2 years after fire gutted Farley business. Nearly 2 years after a fire destroyed Farley's lone grocery store, Greenwood's Grocery is back. The store, owned and operated in the community since 1946, and the apartments above it were destroyed in a May 6, 2022 fire caused by an electrical malfunction from a faulty freezer unit. Wednesday was opening day for the renewed community staple at 112 First Street Northwest. The store is under new ownership, though the tradition of it being a family-owned and operated business will continue. Lori Simon will be assisted by her daughters, Christy Pitts, Jenny Ronebaum, Kelly Henderson, and Ashley Wieland. Simon worked at the store for 20 years before it burned, and her daughters had all had past experience working there too. Though the Greenwood family might no longer be running the store, getting the blessing to have the Greenwood's Grocery name continue was important. When we kept coming up to work in the building, we said, "Let's go to Greenwood's," Pitt said. "The customers are always going to say, 'Let's go to Greenwood's.' Well, if we called it Main Street Market, they'd still call it Greenwood's." So Mom and Dad had the conversation with previous owner Tim Greenwood, because it's their family name and their family tradition. He had no problem with the name remaining, and he's been super supportive, Pitt said. Ever since the fire, community members have lobbied for a grocery store. Back in July 2022, Farley Mayor Jay Heffel told the Telegraph-Herald that the loss was an added hardship for residents, forcing them to travel to neighboring communities for their shopping needs. "It's a troublesome situation to have," Heffel said in 2022. "It's a struggle for a small town to not have its own grocery store." The new owners agree. "I feel like the grocery store is the heart of a town. If you can't have a grocery store in your town, it just can't survive," Pitt said. "I wouldn't want to move here if we didn't have a grocery store. It would be an inconvenience." The plan was always to bring the store back at its previous location, but there were logistics to figure out, because if the building had to be torn down, a new store would likely not have returned to the previous location. When Greenwood asked Simon's husband, Peter Simon, to help with the cleanup process, Peter saw the building was salvageable. "Our dad, Peter, is super sentimental, so he did not want to see this old building go down," Pitt said. "So I think he had it in the back of his mind before anybody ever knew it, that he was doing this and reopening it." During the renovation, decisions were made in stages and as a group, moving from flooring to walls to countertops. "We just kind of had conversations and brainstormed," Pitt said. The family's putting a little bit of its own history in the design, as some of the wood used in the renovation comes from the family farm. "The idea is to have one foot in the past and one in the present," the family said. For both the new owners and locals, the excitement of opening day was palpable in the lead-up. The community, with community members constantly popping into the store, checking progress. "I don't think we can open soon enough," Henderson said, April 11. "The store will be open Monday through Saturday, 7 a.m. to 7 p.m., and Sunday from 8 a.m. to noon." The article is accompanied by a color picture of those mentioned as the employees of the store. There's Lori Simon in the center, and then she's flanked by her daughters on each side as the new owners of Greenwood's Grocery. And the picture depicts the management team is Ashley Wieland, Kelly Henderson, Simon, Christy Pitts, and Jenny Ronebaum. And Jake Bourgeois of the Death Dyers for a Commercial is the one who took the picture as well as wrote the article. And now we turn to the opinion page for a couple of other view columns. The first is by Arthur Cyr, C-Y-R, a frequent contributor and the author of the book After the Cold War. The headline for Arthur Cyr's column is "Iran's Attack on Israel Provokes New Mideast Crisis." The direct attack by Iran on the territory of Israel may lead to an escalation of war in the fraught region of the Middle East. The encouraging news is that Israel, in cooperation with Britain, the United States, and, rather surprisingly, Jordan, did an outstanding job of destroying the approximately 300 drones and missiles launched by Iran. This is dramatic testimony to the effectiveness of defensive anti-missile systems. On the other hand, the attack is a clear break from the recent past. Iran characteristically uses proxies to launch terrorist and other attacks. The fundamentalist regime in Tehran is rightly regarded as a principal instigator of terrorist violence. Iran's leaders have in other circumstances shown restraint in use of force. In 1988, near the end of the long Iran-Iraq war, Saddam Hussein's brutal regime launched massive poison gas attacks against Iran, killing and maiming thousands of people. Iraq was, at the time, a U.S. ally. Tehran did not respond in kind. That same year, U.S. naval forces mistakenly destroyed an Iranian civilian airliner, killing nearly 300 people. Tehran did not retaliate and accepted a financial settlement. The incentive for this recent drone and missile attack was the killing by Israel of 7 officers in an Iran consulate in Syria. Traditionally, consulates and embassies are considered protected territories, facilitators of communications among nations. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is performing yeoman service in the Middle East and elsewhere. Our leaders have important advantages. First, Israel remains dependent on American goodwill as well as aid. Our alliance is based on powerful shared history and values. Second, the important progress in the Middle East has occurred in the context of tensions and even disagreement between Israel and the U.S. President Jimmy Carter was able to achieve an historic treaty between Egypt and Israel. Though occasionally badly frayed, the accord essentially has held. The Suez Crisis of 1956 remains the most serious and destructive of seemingly endless Middle East confrontations. President Dwight Eisenhower used economic leverage and astute diplomacy decisively to end a secretly planned old-style colonial military effort by Britain, France, and Israel to capture the Suez Canal, seized by Egypt's new nationalist regime, and punish Egypt. As usual, Ike's instincts were correct, and American-Israeli relations eventually gained in consequence. There is no need for special anxiety among Americans because relations with our ally again have become characterized by serious tensions. Third, U.S. leaders should slowly seek to expand the alliance with Turkey. The governing religious party is losing ground, and the military so far has not intervened. This contrasts with past crackdowns by the generals to guard the state's secular constitution. Democracy is compromised, but endures in Turkey as elsewhere around the globe. The George W. Bush administration's invasion of Iraq was strongly opposed by Turkey. Fears that terrorism would be fueled proved fully justified, badly damaging relations with Washington. More positive, Turkey-U.S. relations are also very strongly rooted. During the first Persian Gulf War, U.S. B-52 bombers were deployed on Turkey's soil, a potentially risky move by Ankara. Turkey played a vital allied role during the Korean War. The UN military cemetery at Busan contains a notably large number of Turkish graves. Finally, we should combine aggressive pursuit of terrorists with efforts to reduce the American military presence in the Middle East. This combination is promising for long-term stability and U.S. influence. Complete withdrawal from the volatile region, however, would be a mistake. That is the Other View column by Arthur Sear, author of After the Cold War, New York University Press and Palgrave Macmillan Publication. And the Other View column is submitted by Jace Graves, who is an award-winning humor columnist from East Texas. And his column is headlined, Cleaning and Decluttering During a Daughterless Spring Break. Because I'm a professional practitioner of the pedagogical arts, known in some parts as fancy book learning, I'm privileged to enjoy a spring break holiday that usually falls during the same week my semi-grown daughters are also out of school. Back in the good old days, when the girls still spoke to me with actual words, we would spend our spring breaks together, playing in the park, riding bikes, or sharing the trauma of a Disney character's parental death scene. This year, instead of bonding with me and giggling about my excessive ear hair, all three daughters struck out on their own to sigh dramatically and roll their eyes elsewhere. My eldest and most expensive daughter took a trip with a friend and several of my credit cards to enjoy the urban vibrancy of Las Vegas. My middle daughter and her sorority sisters soaked up the sun and repelled the advances of countless pec-flexing goobers on the sugar-white sands of Orange Beach, Alabama. My youngest and quietest daughter communed with nature, her best friend, and a jumbo bag of snack cheese on an all-day picnic. I took the family doglets out to potty several times. Amid these canine assaults on my lawn, I took the opportunity of a daughterless house to do some decluttering. Yes, we are those people who keep things that we might, but probably won't need sometime in the next 50 years, because who knows when that free miniature tube of toothpaste I got from the dentist in 1997 might come in handy, along with the other 34 tubes in the same drawer. I'm sad to say that after an entire week of decluttering, I only made it through our laundry room. The following is a catalog of the clutter I decluttered in there. First, I got rid of two large Rubbermaid tubs full of cables, wires, cords, adapters, and about 100 other electronic computer-type thingies I couldn't identify. I did feel a slight twinge of fear that this stuff might be important, but since I hadn't opened the tubs since it was still cool to wear a pager, I decided I was safe to let them go. Next, I reduced the lifespan of my lumbar spine by lifting down a cardboard box with long-forgotten contents to discover about 60 pounds worth of seashells inside. Yes, seashells. After taking our girls on numerous trips to the beach over the years and allowing them to bring home every fragment, shred, a shard, or sliver of what might once have been a seashell, I'm sure we thought we would get crafty someday and open a seashell decor emporium. Instead, I now have to perform the geezer shuffle when I walk. Next to the seashell hoard was a second mystery box that revealed a complete set of what appeared to be old martini glasses. Neither my wife nor I have any idea where these came from or why they had been marinating in dust on a shelf above our dryer for the past 20-odd years. We've never made a martini or even drunk a martini, and as far as we know, neither have our parents, though mine probably should have done so regularly during my teen years. This summer I plan to have one of my famous garage sales and transfer ownership of these delightful objects to other folks who can find them boxed up in their laundry rooms years from now and wonder where in the heck they came from. So if you're in the market for some old electronic waste or some seashell parts, come on by. Maybe I'll even make you a martini, but probably not. That was the Other View column by Jace Graves, an award-winning humor columnist from East Texas, and there is an accompanying picture of Jace himself. You are listening to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald on this Thursday, April 18th, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. First, the alphabetical list of our brief funeral service listings. Kenneth J. Bakey, B-A-K-E-Y, Kenneth J. Bakey, Dubuque. Visitation 10 a.m. to noon Saturday, April 20, Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory on Rockdale Road. The service noon Saturday at the funeral home. Evelyn M. Bottleman, Greeley, Iowa. Visitation 10 to 11 a.m. today, the Leonard Muller Funeral Home, Edgewoods. Service 11 a.m. today at the funeral home. Benjamin M. Duggan, Maquoketa. Service 3 to 6 p.m. Saturday, April 20, the American Legion Hall on Delhi Street. Millard R. Engelkins, E-N-G-E-L-K-I-N-S, Millard R. Engelkins of Dubuque. Visitation 9:30 to 10:30 Saturday, April 20, St. Joseph the Worker Catholic Church. Service 10:30 a.m. Saturday at the church. Connie L. Gropfert, G-E-O-P-F-E-R-T, Gepfert, perhaps. Connie L. Gepfert, Wilton, Iowa. Celebration of Life, 4 to 8 p.m. Friday, April 19th, the Bellevue State Park Lodge. James R. Holman, Galena, Illinois. Visitation, 10 a.m. to noon, Friday, April 19, Furlong Funeral Chapel, Galena. Service, noon, Friday, at the chapel. Linda S. Ludovisi, L-U-D-O-V-I-S-S-Y. Linda S. Ludovisi, North Buena Vista, Iowa. Visitation, noon to 12:45 p.m. today, Immaculate Conception Parish Hall, North Buena Vista. Service 1 p.m. today at the church. Dennis H. Neuser, N-E-U-S-E-R, Dennis H. Neuser, Platteville, Wisconsin. Visitation 10 to 11 a.m. Saturday, April 20, First English Lutheran Church, Platteville. Celebration of Life, 11 a.m. Saturday at the church. Donald C. Progar, P-R-O-G-A-R, Donald C. Progar, Asbury, Iowa. Visitation 10 to 11:30 a.m. Saturday, April 20, Sacred Heart Catholic Church, Mass of Christian Burial, 11:30 a.m. Saturday at the church. Robert J. Schoenhoff, S-C-H-O-N-H-O-F-F, Robert J. Schoenhoff, Hazel Green, Wisconsin. Visitation 9:30 to 10:45 a.m. today at St. Francis de Sales Catholic Church, Hazel Green. Mass of Christian Burial, 11 a.m. today at the church. K. Snow, Clinton, Iowa. Visitation, 3:30 to 5:30 p.m., Friday, April 26, Law Jones Funeral Home, Hanover, Illinois. Service, 5:30 p.m., Friday, at the funeral home. Martin A. Pitts, P-I-T-Z, Martin A. Pitts, Welton, Iowa. Visitation 3 to 7 p.m. today, the Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory on Rockdale Road. Service 7 p.m. today at the funeral home. Dean Werger, that's first name is D-E-A-N-E-W-E-R-G-E-R, Dean Werger, Garnavillo, Iowa. Visitation 9 to 11 a.m. Friday, April 19, St. Paul Lutheran Church, Garnavillo. Service 11 a.m. Friday at the church. And finally, Thomas J. Zenner, Z-E-N-N-E-R, Thomas J. Zenner, Piazza, Iowa. Visitation noon to 3 p.m., Sunday, April 21, the Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory on Rockdale Road. Service 10:30 a.m., Monday, April 22, Holy Trinity Catholic Church. And now we report our regular obituary listings. David B. Somers, S-O-M-E-R-S, David Byron Somers, loving husband, devoted father, grandfather, brother, and friend, passed away peacefully at Select Specialty Hospital in Davenport due to complications relating to Parkinson's disease on April 15th at the age of 68. Funeral services, 10 a.m. on Saturday, April 20, at the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints on Fremont Avenue in Dubuque. There will be a visitation on Friday, April 19th, 5:30 p.m. to 7:30 p.m. at Hoffman, Schneider, and Kitchen Funeral Home on Asbury Road, and from 9 a.m. until 9:45 prior to the service on Saturday at the church. Interment will be at the Dubuque Memorial Garden Cemetery. Full military honors will be rendered by the American Legion Post Number 6 and the Mid-Atlantic Region Navy Honor Guard. That's for David B. Summers, David Byron Summers of Dubuque. Marion Lee Mim Huilman, H-U-I-L-M-A-N, Miriam Lee Mim Huilman, 75, of Platteville, died Friday, April 12th. A celebration of life will be held Sunday, April 21, at the Melby Funeral Home and Crematory, Platteville, from 1 to 3 p.m., where there will be a memorial service, 1:30 p.m. The pastor, Marianne Florkey, will officiate. Online condolences may be offered at the Melby Funeral Home website. As for Miriam Lee, known as Mim Huilman, 75, of Platteville. Sarah Ann Schauer Rick, that's the last two names are S-C-H-A-U-E-R-R-I-C-K-E. Sarah Ann Schauer Rick, 49, of Austin, Texas, formerly of Dubuque, died on Tuesday, October 23rd of 2023. Graveside services 11:30 Saturday, April 20, at Linwood Cemetery. Kenneth L. Geis, G-E-I-S-Z, Kenneth L. Geis, 86, of Lanark, Illinois, died on Tuesday, April 9th. Celebration of life will be held 1 to 4 p.m. Saturday, May 4th, at Manny's Pizza in Savannah, where a memorial service will take place at 2:30 p.m. Barry will be at a later date in Lanark Cemetery. The Law Jones Funeral Home of Savannah is assisting the family of Kenneth L. Geis, G-E-I-S-Z, of Lanark, Illinois. Stanley G. Samuel, 53, of St. Donatus, died on Wednesday, April 10th. Visitation will be held 1 to 3 p.m. Saturday, April 21st, at the Bear Funeral Home on Main Street, where services will follow. The burial will take place in the Linwood Cemetery at a later date for Stanley G. Samuel of St. Donatus, Iowa. Terry Frank, F-R-A-N-K, Terry Frank, 87, of Dubuque, died on Tuesday, April 16th. Visitation 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Tuesday, April 23rd, at the Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory on Rockdale Road, where services will follow for Terry Frank, 87, of Dubuque. Virginia Jenny Murphy died on March 22nd of 2024. Jenny lived in Oconomowoc, Wisconsin, and it doesn't give her age, but it says she was born on October 17th of 1934. It says that private services will be held for the family at a later date, and it says that they were held already. That's Virginia Jenny Murphy of Oconomowoc, Wisconsin. Bruce L. Hansen, 75, of Garnavello, died Saturday, April 13. Visitation 4 to 7 p.m. Sunday, April 21, and from 10 to 11 a.m. Monday, April 22, at St. John's Lutheran Church in Gutenberg, where services will follow. Burial will take place in Garnavello City Cemetery. The Garrity Funeral Home of Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin, is assisting the family of Bruce L. Hansen of Garnavello. Daryl F. Jones, 84, of Dubuque, died on Tuesday, April 16th. Visitation 3 to 7 p.m. Sunday, April 21, at Egelhoff Siegert and Casper Funeral Home and Crematory on John F. Kennedy Road. Mass of Christian burial, 10 a.m. Monday, April 22nd, St. Patrick Church. Interment will be in St. Paul Cemetery, Mineral Point, Wisconsin, for Daryl F. Jones, 84, of Dubuque. And that concludes the obituaries in today's edition. And now we turn to the sports page for the Telegraph Herald's weekly athlete of the week. This time it is Ava Hahn of Galena. And the headline, Hahn keeps opposing sitters whiffing. This is reported by Shannon Mum. And Hahn's last name is spelled A-H-A-H-N. Junior Ava Hahn continues to be a force in the pitching circle for the Galena Pirates. The Telegraph Herald Athlete of the Week has already struck out 100 batters through 9 games this season, including a 16-strikeout performance against West Carroll last week. 2 days later, Hahn threw her third career no-hitter in a 6-1 win over West Carroll. She struck out 11 while going 2-for-3 at the plate. Ava has really gained more strength since last season, Galena coach Jerry Westermeyer said. She works on her pitching year-round, and she's really seen that hard work pay off. You can see that she is dedicated to the sport. She is averaging about 12 strikeouts per game this year, and she is hitting the ball well, too. Hahn earned second-team All-State honors last season as a sophomore after finishing the season with 234 strikeouts and an ERA of 4.58. Offensively, she batted 464 with an on-base percentage of 532 and a team-high 32 hits. She bats second in our lineup and is a solid line-drive hitter for us, Westheimer said. She's getting a lot more extra base hits this year. She is currently hitting .379 with 11 hits and 5 RBIs. I struggled with my hitting at the beginning of the season, but it's starting to come along, Hahn said. I put a lot of time in during the winter on my swing. Hahn's pitching continues to keep hitters guessing with her crafty changeup. My changeup is pretty good, she said. I have a few different pitches I can throw to keep them on their toes. Hahn said she enjoys the challenges that come with pitching. If I'm not throwing well, the team isn't going to do well, she said. It's important for me to be focused every time I step into the circle, because I know my team is counting on me to throw strikes. Hahn is already receiving interest from college coaches. She's done a great job of taking more of a leadership role this season, and she's just a good person away from the softball field, too. She's a great student, and she has a lot of potential to do big things after high school. There's a picture of Ava in action as she seems to be running the bases. Hahn's, and the caption says, Galena's Ava Hahn struck out a combined 27 batters in a pair of games last week against West Carroll. Now we return to the opinion page for the single letter to the editor. This is written by Howard Hammerand on Clover Lane, Asbury, Iowa. And the headline, Sincerely Held Belief, Enough to Impact Law? Interesting to read that in Indiana, the Hoosier Jews for Choice and the ACLU believe that, quote, the ability to obtain an abortion is necessary based on a sincerely held religious belief, unquote, and that a 3-judge panel agreed with a lower court in that regard. Seems like the judges wouldn't have a problem then with prior cultures and religious services that practiced human sacrifice as long as it was, quote, sincerely held belief, unquote. That's the letter to the editor in today's Telegraph Herald, and that was submitted by Howard Hammerand on Clover Lane, Asbury, Iowa. On page 8, we have a story written by the Telegraph Herald, Key City Creative Center to host reception for 2 area artists. Key City Creative Center will host a reception and art show for 2 tri-state artists from 6 to 8 p.m. Friday, April 19, at the center at 1781 White Street. Tim Olson, 2022 State of Iowa Artist Fellow, will exhibit 4 stained glass panels featuring notable Iowans. The window panels, which are loosely based on Gothic-style church windows, include Halston, the fashion designer, Cheryl Brown, Miss Iowa, 1970, Dan Gable, Olympic wrestler, and Denise Long, the first woman drafted by the NBA. Olson studied art photography at the University of Iowa and worked as a printer in Los Angeles and Chicago for 20 years before returning to Iowa. He paints and works on stained glass projects in his studios at Key City Creative Center. He has exhibited photographs, paintings, and drawings throughout the U.S., most recently at La Luz de Jesus Gallery in Los Angeles. After the preview exhibit at Key City, Olson's glass panels will be featured in a solo exhibit at the Sioux City Art Center. Dan Alderman, multimedia artist in residence at Pound Town Twisted Arts, will be exhibiting his sculpture, Space Plus Time Equals the Moment. He was awarded the Creative Empowerment Grant by the City of Dubuque Office of Arts and Cultural Affairs and the National Endowment for the Arts. Alderman was lead operator of a printing press for 20 years. His eye for color and inclination for solving mechanical problems led him to metalwork, sculpture, and drawing. He has shown copper pieces at the Bisignano Art Gallery and University of Dubuque Heritage Center. He has won Best of Show at Dubuque's Art on the River and has had drawings featured at Figge Art Museum in Davenport. He collaborated his current piece at Art on the River with fellow artist Evan Prosch. Key City Creative Center is a nonprofit makerspace with more than 80 members. The 11,000 square foot facility is on the central curve and features a wood shop, craft room, metal shop, and more than 40 private studios. For more information, visit KeyCityCreativeCenter.org. On the Lifestyle and Arts page, also, we have a story about Hempstead's The Miracle Worker, an inspiring true story. The play, The Miracle Worker, will be performed by the Dubuque Hempstead High School, and it will be performed Thursday through Saturday, May 2nd through the 4th, at 7 p.m. at the Dubuque Hempstead High School Auditorium on Pennsylvania Avenue. The cost, $10 for the general public, $5 for students. Tickets are general admission only and are sold at the door beginning at 6:30 p.m. A synopsis of the play. Based on true events, the play opens in Tuscumbia, Alabama, where an illness has rendered infant Helen Keller blind, deaf, and mute. Badly spoiled by her parents, Helen is taught no discipline and grows into a wild, angry, tantrum-throwing child in control of the household. Desperate, the Kellers hire visually impaired Annie Sullivan to serve as Helen's governess and teacher. Annie teaches Helen discipline through persistence and consistency and language through hand signals, a double breakthrough that changes Helen's life and has a direct effect on the lives of her and her family. And then there are some tidbits listed. The disclaimer, families are welcome to attend. The show has a PG rating, parental guidance suggested, and is family friendly with some caution. Parents should use their own discretion when considering what works for their family. 24 students are in the cast, with 20 students also making up the stage crew. Within a month of working with Annie Sullivan, Helen's vocabulary increased to hundreds of words and simple sentences. Annie also taught Helen how to read Braille and to print block letters. Helen became an advocate and a humanitarian and won many awards throughout her life. Annie was her constant teacher, interpreter, and friend. She accompanied Helen to every school she attended, including Ratcliffe College. The play, written by William Gibson, was inspired by Helen's 1903 autobiography, The Story of My Life. Actress Patty Duke, who originated the role of Helen Keller on stage won an Academy Award for Best Supporting Actress for the film adaptation, and Bancroft won Best Actress for her role as Annie Sullivan. The Miracle Worker is the state of Alabama's official outdoor drama and is performed every year at Ivy Green, Helen's childhood home in Tuscumbia, Alabama. The report is written by Michelle London. Again, that is the performance scheduled of The Miracle Worker at Hempstead High School on the 2nd through the 4th of May, and it's at Hempstead High School's auditorium, The Miracle Worker. And a news in brief item, headline, Humane Society to Hold Microchip Clinic. An upcoming clinic will provide pet owners a low-cost opportunity to microchip their animals. The clinic will be held from 11 a.m. to 6:30 p.m. Friday, April 19th, at Dubuque Regional Humane Society on Chavanel Road. According to a press release, the regular walk-in price to implant a microchip is $40. The price during the clinic will be $25. No appointment is needed, but to participate, dogs must be on leash and cats must be in carriers. The release states that animals with a microchip are reunited with their families at a much higher rate than pets without microchips. You can visit the website dbqhumane.org for more information. And the outlook for tomorrow's weather predicts mostly sunny and windy, with a high temperature of 54 and a low of 30. The wind will be out of the west at 12 to 25 miles per hour. And that does it for today's reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald on this Thursday, April 18th. I'm your reader, Wally Helms. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.
People's Pharmacy Health Headlines. At high doses, nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory drugs like diclofenac, ibuprofen, or naproxen may increase the risk of kidney problems. The study that revealed this used de-identified medical records of more than 750,000 active duty U.S. Army soldiers. Consequently, these were active young and middle-aged adults. During the time of the study, from 2011 through 2014, nearly 18% of these soldiers got a prescription for 1 to 7 doses of an NSAID pain reliever in a month. Another 16% were prescribed more than 7 doses in a month. Fewer than 1% of these people were subsequently diagnosed with acute or chronic kidney disease. Nevertheless, the rate of kidney trouble was about 20% higher among people who had received high-dose NSAIDs than among those who had taken none. The authors described the increased risk as modest but statistically significant.
Another class of drugs that can lead to kidney injury is proton pump inhibitors. A data mining initiative of the FDA's Adverse Event Reporting System analyzed kidney-related side effects among 43,000 people who took a drug such as esomeprazole, lansoprazole, or omeprazole. Approximately 8,000 people taking a histamine 2 blocker such as ranitidine or famotidine served as controls, since they take these drugs for similar symptoms. The researchers found that 5.6% of people on PPIs alone had a kidney-related side effect, while only 0.7% of those on H2 blockers did. Chronic kidney disease was 28 times more likely, and acute kidney injury was 4 times more likely among people taking PPIs. While this analysis shows association, not causation, there are previous studies linking PPIs and kidney damage.
There's growing concern about a mysterious infectious disease that has been spreading among the wild deer population for decades. Scientists call it CWD, or chronic wasting disease. Hunters refer to this condition as zombie deer disease. It can also affect elk and moose. The CDC reports that this infectious disease has spread to wildlife in 24 states and 2 Canadian provinces. CWD was first detected in Colorado among captive deer in the 1960s and in the wild deer population in the 1980s. It's now affecting deer in the Midwest, Southwest, and some parts of the East Coast. The disease appears to be caused by a prion infection reminiscent of mad cow disease. An infectious disease expert at the University of Minnesota has warned that hunters who eat contaminated deer meat may eventually develop the human equivalent of chronic wasting disease.
Shoulder replacement surgery is becoming increasingly common. Now researchers writing in the BMJ say that patients should be warned that the risks are higher than originally thought. The investigators reviewed hospital and mortality records in the UK. When men between 50 and 59 have this type of shoulder surgery, 1 in 4 will need further surgery on that shoulder within 5 years. In addition, older people who underwent this kind of surgical procedure experienced high rates of serious adverse events. 1 in 9 older women and 1 in 5 older men had an infection, major blood clot, heart attack or stroke, or died within 3 months. The authors of the study encouraged their colleagues to counsel patients about the risks as well as the benefits of this kind of surgery.
Drug interactions are a serious hazard in hospitals and the community. If patients receive prescriptions for incompatible medications, they can experience severe side effects that may even be life-threatening. Electronic medical records are intended to warn prescribers and pharmacists about potentially dangerous interactions, but many do so indiscriminately. The result is something called alert fatigue. If clinicians receive too many warnings, they may not pay attention to the really important ones. A team at St. Jude Children's Research Hospital reviewed their alert system. They removed unnecessary alerts and provided additional information to the most important ones. After they finished, they tracked clinicians' reactions. Alert overrides dropped by 40%. One important change linked alerts to the patient's laboratory data, making them much more targeted. And that's the health news from the People's Pharmacy this week.